The middle of the week and a busy old day on Radio 1. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
His first nickname actually was Heinrich von Steichen, bang, bang, bang. But that was a bit of a mouthful. So we changed that to Bonavox of O'Connell Street. And my nickname was The Edge. I think Larry's was The Jam Jar, and Adam was Mrs. Burns. So for whatever reason, Bonavox of O'Connell Street got shortened to Bono, and The Edge stuck, and we just ran with it.
The defining issue of the 21st century is, as far as we know, going to be climate change. We need to create a climate of trust. That's the hope.
The interesting thing for me is that I don't fit into my jeans from my 21st. They're too big.
Right.
And we'll start in the morning with the Ryan Tuberty Show. And it's a beautiful week for you too. Their new album, Songs of Surrender, and Bono and the Edge's A Sort of Homecoming with David Letterman will be released. And to mark these events, The Edge was talking to Ryan.
Really busy, but really good.
I know it is. I mean, I've got in front of me so many places to go. First of all, let me ask you, the last time I think I saw you was probably in Berlin or something like that. And you were on stage, and it was all you're coming and going. So it's nice to be able to sit down in this way, even though you're not with me in face to face to say hello properly. How was the last 2 or 3 years for you and your family? How have you been?
I've been okay. I mean, to be honest, the lockdown was weird for everybody. Yeah. But if you're a songwriter, music composer, as I am, it was just a kind of excuse to put your head down and just work. So I found it in some ways beneficial, and that's a weird thing to say, but it is the case. And then, you know, not being on stage, not performing, felt a bit weird. We'd just come off a 5-year cycle of touring, so you miss that definitely. There's a kind of a come down after touring for that long. But itching to do some more shows and itching to get some new music out. And then also we got this new thing coming out, Songs of Surrender, which is reinterpretations of some of our classic songs, which is coming out any day. So lots going on and all good stuff.
Yeah, the Songs of Surrender, the tunes I've heard from it, they're so beautiful. And I know this is... Well, let me ask you about this. Everyone keeps saying to me, this really matters to The Edge. And I'm hearing that a lot. This is clearly really close to your heart and, dare I say it, your soul. Why is this so personal to you?
Well, there's something about songs to me that are like gifts. You know, they arrive, they're kind of mysterious and magical. And you talk to any songwriter and they will explain them in the same way, as suddenly this thing exists, which didn't exist, you know, before. And they have this power, you know, if they are a strong piece of work, they have a power to become part of the fabric of people's lives, not just the people that wrote them, but, you know, the fans of those bands. In this case, I think both Bono and I had a long-standing kind of belief that some of our early recordings, we were just way wound up. We were intense young men trying to prove ourselves, trying to get our music across. And the recordings reflected that. So listening back, we always felt, wow, you know, we could probably do these in a different way that would make the songs shine just as pure songs, not necessarily as new recordings that would eclipse the previous recordings, because they're classic. We're not taking those away. We're not deleting previous U2 albums. But just to give a different slant, a different dimension to those songs. And, you know, we've seen it work on a couple of classics when we would play them live. I'm thinking of songs like Every Breaking Wave or Staring at the Sun that ended up becoming iconic in their stripped down version. So the theory was, well, could we do that to a song like Bad? Could we do that to a song like Pride? And it was a bit of an experiment, to be honest. During lockdown, I felt I had the time to try and see where it might lead us. And that was the great discovery, was when Bono started singing over some of these demo arrangements, to discover that, yes, in fact, a great song is kind of indestructible, and you can play it in different ways and arrange it in different styles. It's still the same song in essence, but you might understand it in a different way. You might have a deeper sense of really what it's communicating. And that's what I've discovered making these new arrangements and this Songs of Surrender collection, is these songs have different dimensions. And by presenting this way, I think people will fall in love with them all over again, which is kind of what happened to us.
Yeah, it reminds me, as you're speaking of, you know, you could read Catcher in the Rye at 20 and understand it in a certain way, and then read it at 40 or 50 with a whole new life experience in your brain, and read a totally different book. And that's my feeling about these songs. You know, I was playing a little parlor game in my head sometimes, going, trying to play the original song in parallel with the new version of it. And the new version is so stripped back. I was saying a few minutes ago, it reminded me of the Unplugged gigs, the MTV Unplugged. It reminded me a little bit of, you know, like Bono's voice in it, and you're playing, certainly Bono's voice, obviously, like Sinatra, getting older, more lived in, more experience, more pain, maybe more joy, more realization. That is a different voice, and therefore a different song in some ways.
I think that's right. And also to make these lyrics reflect where we're at today, not just as people, but events. So for instance, Walk On, we rewrote with a sort of nod to Ukraine, because that's what's happening right now in our world, in our life, that we feel needs and deserves a spotlight. So those sorts of realignments, or a song like Stories for Boys, which we wrote when we were boys, and we were trying to explain, you know, what was going on in our lives and where we were in the world. Now, singing that, you know, without reviewing and revising the lyric would have felt quite odd. But we rewrote it now, actually talking about the boys we were back then, and giving a new light to the characters we were as we were just about starting out. So it's, I think it gives the songs a new life in a way.
And Ryan wondered about the mixed emotions of the retrospective.
You're giving a very a much more cheerful interpretation of this retrospective, if you like, than I, because at one stage I was listening to it and I wrote down mortality, existential. And I was asking myself, okay, when I knew I was going to be talking to you, you know, is there a sense, is there a wistful, you know, being of a certain vintage now, looking back about it all, or is it, as I've just said, much more joyful than that?
Well, it's both, I think, and that's the beauty of music, is you can hold contrasting ideas in your hand at the same time. So with Stories for Boys, it's like there's an awe about, you know, the power of youth and, you know, what there was there in potential, but also a pathos about, you know, looking back at that time. And I think that's what's emotionally interesting, is the complexity here is not a singular thing. Like City of Blinding Lights, you know, which is usually a full bore celebratory rock song, in this context, it's got a lot of self-doubt and a much more kind of vulnerable emotion to it. And I think that makes it really interesting.
When you mentioned Ukraine there, and you played in the bunker, I thought that was very moving. What was that like for you guys to be there, knowing that chaos was raining down overhead?
It was a whole host of mixed feelings and emotions. First of all, you know, a little trepidatious, because you're arriving by train from Poland, so it takes you basically 12 hours to get there. And as we're drawing into the main station in Kyiv, the sirens are going off. So you're aware of the fact this is a real war zone. It's not pretend. And we found out later their missiles had arrived into the city at that moment. But then you come across the Ukrainian people, and we actually had the honor of meeting President Zelensky and his chief of staff, and you just get a sense of their courage, and so it's very inspiring. And then, unfortunately, we got a tour of some of the areas where the Russians had occupied, and you just understand the horrors of what went on in those parts of Ukraine, and that we visited the mass graves of civilians who'd just been killed. And so that was extremely upsetting, obviously. But we left feeling that this is a united country behind a just cause. And I mean, it's very hard. I can't imagine the Ukrainian people and the military not prevailing in the end, simply because they're fighting for a completely different set of reasons. And I feel so sorry for all the Russian conscripts, you know, being used as cannon fodder. And I mean, it's a terrible position that they find themselves in. And it's one man, basically, one man on a crazy mission. And so it was, quite a trip.
The Edge. And we'll come back to that conversation with Ryan Tuberty a bit later in the programme. And in the afternoon, we'll get to 12-year-old expert Aina soon. But first, Joe Duffy was talking about the last days of former President Jimmy Carter on the Live Line.
Jimmy Carter, the 39th President of the United States of America, President from 1977 to 1981, won the Nobel Prize, was a four-term president. He has announced, or his family have announced, as you probably heard in the last month, that his end is near, and he's a man of great faith and a man who accepts his fate. And he's now at home undergoing, in the presence of apparently all his children and grandchildren, as of today, are gathered around his bedside. And Joe Biden, President Biden, announced, or let it slip rather, a few days ago, that Jimmy Carter asked President Biden to deliver the eulogy at his funeral, which is, I don't know if people are normally asked beforehand, would you do the eulogy at my funeral? But he has asked, and he didn't make any particular demands. But Jimmy Carter has visited Ireland on a number of occasions after he was president. And indeed, I was at an event in Ballyfermot about 15 years ago where the great Finbar Fury, also from Ballyfermot, Finbar turned the sod in a housing development which was funded and encouraged by the Jimmy Carter Foundation, because that's what he was doing. So he's done incredible work. Michael Martin. Michael, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe, to you and your listeners.
And you met Jimmy Carter.
I met him briefly, yes.
Tell us.
Well, I was in California at the time. I was there as a visiting scholar at the University College of Berkeley, the University of California College of Berkeley. And I saw a notice one evening that he was over in a place nearby called Corte Madeira.
Okay.
And he was doing a book signing, you know. And I had sat along and admired his efforts in the Middle East. And things like that. I thought he was kind of a stand-up guy. So I went over and, you know, stood in line with others and got to meet him briefly and exchange a few words while he signed a copy of his book for me.
But he's written a number of books. Which one was that, do you remember?
Well, it was the one called We Can Have Peace in the Holy Land. I kind of admired the fact that he had done a lot of work and was responsible really for the Camp David Accords and the agreement that came after.
Right.
While it all mightn't have turned out the way he wanted it,
well, in truth, it was the most hopeful moment in that intractable conflict. The most hopeful moment probably was the Camp David Accords under Jimmy Carter's leadership. So. And that's, isn't that why he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize? And tell us,
exactly.
What was the setup like? Does a former president have, like he would have been, he's 98 now. He's the longest, the oldest living former president and the longest living president, if you follow me, at 98.
Yes, yeah.
What did he have? He'd hardly have a security. Who'd interfere with
the man? There was Secret Service, or maybe not so Secret Service, but there was clearly security at the venue. It was a large bookstore in Corte Madeira, but there were security there for him at the time. And I'm not sure if all past presidents get us, but they were certainly there. And maybe, you know, the subject being topical as it was, They wanted to have security, but there was security and evidence all right there. But he just came across a very pleasant man and exchanged a few words. And, you know, in the tradition of Americans, you don't get it much in Ireland. But he asked me about my interest. I said, well, I served in the Middle East, you know. Well, and he said, well, thank you for your service, sir. He said to me.
Which is a phrase they use. They use every... Every, as they call them, patriots in the States who've been in the services.
Well, that's Michael Martin there. And Joe played a clip of Jimmy Carter from 1977.
Tomorrow will be 2 weeks since I became president. I've spent a lot of time deciding how I can be a good president. This talk, which the broadcast networks have agreed to bring to you, is one of several steps that I will take to keep in close touch with the people of our country, to let you know informally about our plans for the coming months. When I was running for president, I made a number of commitments. I take them very seriously. I believe that they were the reason that I was elected. And I want you to know that I intend to carry them out.
And people will remember, one, he was a peanut farmer. Secondly, he was a pastor. And he's actually... He's been a pastor every Sunday up to quite recently, and again in Plains in Georgia where he lived.
And then Richie called Joe.
Yeah, Jimmy Carter, I think it was from his service days. He was a nuclear technician. When Three Mile Island happened, he wanted to help. And against the advice of his, naturally, his Secret Service agent, who didn't want to be anywhere near the place and a whole lot of other people, he flew down there and based himself there until it was cleared, and he helped organize. Oh. Yeah. And I was always surprised that he never got kudos for that in the next election for helping save Three Mile Island.
You see, the image of Jimmy Carter is that he was of great intent.
Yes, he was.
Extraordinarily decent, hardworking. But I was reading an article recently about him. It's from the Brookings Institute in the States. But they were saying he was a failure because... He had this belief that governance could be done by relying on good people rather than having overriding goals and maybe trampling on people in the meantime. But that he didn't have the substance. Now, there's the argument, and people say, sure, every Taoiseach or every American president goes up in everyone's estimation after they've left office. What do you think is Jimmy Carter's legacy, or what will be in this eulogy he's requested?
That he was a peacemaker and a hard worker and has done probably more after being president than when he was president. Yeah. You'd rarely hear somebody say a bad word against Carter.
Well, that's true, but does that make a good president?
No.
Especially in the American context where it's the executive.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but I think part of the problem with America, Joe, is all the cards were stacked against him at the time, and the way you have the two-party system and one hitting the other, and whether he had control, I can't remember whether he had control of the houses at the time, which wouldn't have helped if he didn't. Part of the problem is that he would have been blocked at everything he did anyway. So we see it happening with Joe Biden. The Republicans are doing their best to block everything, whether it's good or bad. So even if it's bad, they're just blocking out of party politics. So Jimmy Carter would have had the same problems over there. So no matter what he did, he was always going to be the bad guy anyway. And Ronald Reagan, when he came along in the next election with the Reagan policy, which dictated the way the Republicans run today, that didn't help in the election either, because there's more Republican support with the gun support and everything in America. So I suppose it didn't help Carter that he was more good people will do good things. It's a case of who's richest and who's loudest will seem to call the shots in America.
Well, that's Richie. But then the amazing 12-year-old Jimmy Carter expert, Aina, called Joe.
Aina Clinch. Aina, good afternoon.
Hello there.
What age are you, Aina?
I'm 12 years old.
Why are you not in school?
I'm in school right now. I'm on the school phone in the office.
Brilliant. And how did you end up on the school phone in the office, Aina?
Well, I was in school and I got called down here, and I said, they told me that there was LMFM was here waiting for me, and I was over the moon because I sent an email maybe 3 or 2 weeks ago. My dad told me to.
Okay, well,
and
it's
it was
not
about Jimmy Carter.
Yeah, well, it's not LMFM. It's RT Radio 1. You're on Live Line. My name is Joe Duffy. And Aina, the reason is your dad sent us in an email saying, even though you're only 12 years of age, as you've just told us, that you have an enormous interest in Jimmy Carter, President Jimmy Carter.
Yes, I do. I have a big interest
well,
in
tell
President
us,
Carter.
Tell us about him, what you've read about him and what you know about him. And you've travelled.
Well, President Jimmy Carter, as the 39th President of the United States, was elected in 1976.
Okay.
And he won against Gerald Ford.
Yeah.
Gerald Ford was president at the time, and it was after the Nixon era where people were kind of left with no trust in their government. But then Jimmy Carter came along, and Gerald Ford, who was Nixon's vice president, didn't win a second term. And Jimmy Carter was in, and everybody seemed to have great confidence in him.
Okay. And you then went to the United States of America?
Yes.
Tell us about that holiday.
Well, I went to New York and Florida with all of my family. Owen, Emma, and then my mom and my dad. And I was over the moon, seeing as it was my first time in the United States and I had so much interest in everything there.
Okay.
We went to New York City and Orlando. And while in Orlando, we actually had a car rental.
Okay.
And me and my parents have been speaking about going to planes for such a long time now. But I never really thought it would have happened until now.
Okay, so you hopped in the car, the rental car, the three of you.
Yeah.
And instead of going to Disney...
It was only me and my dad.
Only the two of you, okay. Instead of going to Disney World, where most people your age want to spend all the time, you started driving to Jimmy Carter's home place.
Of Plains, Georgia, yes.
And do you remember how long the journey was, Aina?
Oh, it was maybe 6 hours, but I like 6 hours too, and then another 6 hours back.
Okay, so
I think me and my dad thought it was completely worth it, the whole thing.
Well, tell us what happened when you arrived, and what age were you then, Aina? You're 12 now.
I was 11.
11, okay. So this 11-year-old arrived in Plains, Georgia. Tell us about it.
Well, I think it was very significant, but it was in the middle of nowhere in Georgia. It was up near. It was kind of in the mid-countryside of Georgia, so I didn't really know what to think.
Okay.
And then I remember we went to the tour guide information, and there was this lovely old southern lady there, and she was telling us all about it. And something I found very fascinating was that everyone who seemed to live in Plains grew up with Jimmy Carter, and they still meet Jimmy Carter to this day.
Okay.
I found that very fascinating. And then we got two maps of Plains, and I kept them, and I still have them at my house today.
Oh, well done, well done. And did you go to where he was born?
I did. I went to his home place and I saw his high school and his boyhood farm where his dad originally started it. And it was all very fascinating.
He was a peanut farmer.
He was a peanut, yes. And so was his father.
And is it still a peanut farm, do you know, ain't it?
It is still a peanut farm because I saw it there and there were still the crops. But I think it was the national park workers take control.
Now, did you go and what did you, is Plains, Georgia, where you travelled with your dad?
Yeah, Plains, Georgia.
Is it totally obsessed with Jimmy Carter?
Yes,
you follow
him? It's totally obsessed. But there's signs everywhere and there's buildings everywhere and there's loads of banners, home of the 39th President Jimmy Carter, you know?
Wow, that's 12-year-old Aina, super fan of former President Jimmy Carter, on the Lifeline with Joe Duffy. And on Today with Claire Byrne, preventative cardiologist Dr. Paddy Barrett was explaining why it's important to be able to fit into the genes you owned when you were 21.
I think it acts as a really good proxy indicator of your waist circumference. We know that when we think about weight, we often talk about body mass index, and we know that it's a fantastic tool for understanding the health of populations. But at an individual level, it's not the best indicator. And that's why we often use waist circumference, which technically isn't your gene size, it's just above it. But it's a really good indicator to say that over the period of time, since the time that you were likely to be at your ideal weight, has your waist circumference increased to a significant degree?
Because you're not really interested in somebody's weight per se, is that right?
Correct. I think because when we think about weight, we're really asking is what is the total weight of all of your bones, of your lean mass, like your muscle, of subcutaneous fat and visceral fat? And ultimately, what we want is we want high levels of muscle mass and low levels of visceral fat. That is the optimal body composition. The opposite of that is called sarcopenia, where you have low muscle mass and high visceral fat or high fat levels, because that's where we have the highest degree of risk associated with it. And this is to do with this idea that there's two main compartments of fat. One is being subcutaneous fat and the other is visceral fat. And the risk really comes from the visceral fat.
Okay, so talk to me about those types of fat. Subcutaneous is the fat we can see under our skin.
Correct. And so that's the fat kind of on your side, the stuff that you can pinch. So everyone's very, very aware of that. Now, the reality is everyone has differing amounts of that they can store. So if you think about your fat cell being like either a tennis ball or a beach ball, and as you fill it up, so if you only have a tennis ball size there, it gets to a certain threshold, and then basically it has to put it somewhere else, and it spills over into your visceral fat. And visceral fat is the fat that is inside your abdominal cavity. It's the stuff that's in your liver, it's in your, you know, major organs, and that is where you get this engine of inflammation that drives all the health consequences of being overweight. Now, why this is important is that the subcutaneous fat, while it may go up and down, it is very biologically inert insofar as that it adds very little in terms of your risk. And we see this with patients, say, who are very significantly overweight, but maybe it's predominantly driven by a huge amount of subcutaneous fat. And we often refer to these individuals as metabolically healthy obese. So they meet the obesity criteria, but they don't have any of the metabolic consequences.
Okay, so but then you have patients who look slimmer but are actually far more unhealthy than the people who are clearly obese.
Correct. And so this is actually probably the main takeaway point from this. I think when people fall into the overweight category, there's a very obvious physical reminder that this may be something that they need to pay attention to. But it's the individual who's actually not particularly overweight, who has excess visceral fat, but not a significant amount of subcutaneous fat. And we know this in particularly Southeast Asian populations, where they don't, you know, become significantly overweight, but they have very small subcutaneous compartments, but all of that fat then has to go into their visceral fat, and they develop very serious metabolic consequences like coronary artery disease and diabetes at weights much lower than we would.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, isn't it? Just going back to what you said about fat cells being able to manage to contain a tennis ball amount of fat, this subcutaneous fat that you were telling us about, and then the beach ball. Why are different people capable of storing more subcutaneous fat than others?
So there's a lot of different theories as to why. Some people refer to it as what's called your personal fat threshold, or mm-hmm. there's a theory called the adipose overflow hypothesis. And the thesis is that this is something that is likely a genetic set point that you have early in life. So you have a fixed number of cells, but those cells then have differing degrees of size. So as you gain weight, you're not gaining more of those cells. You're actually just filling them up to a greater and greater degree. And if you have the beach ball capacity, you can just keep filling them up and keep filling them up. And clearly, as you get to kind of larger size, some of it will go over into the visceral fat, but more of it will stay in the subcutaneous fat. And that is the concern here is we often refer to different body shapes and sizes, like this kind of pear shape or apple shape. And there are, say, certain females, for example, that carry more weight on their thighs, but have very, very narrow waists. And so they're likely to be metabolically healthy. Whereas someone has a large abdominal cavity, we're looking at a much more higher likelihood of visceral fat and the inflammation.
So that brings us back to where we started and your interest in the waistline and the genes fitting you, because that's telling you there's a visceral fat problem.
So that acts as a very good proxy for that. So if your genes don't fit you in the idealized sense, the likelihood of visceral fat being higher is much higher. And then we have to say, listen, well, if that's the case, what I'm interested in really is the complications that come from that or the consequences. So with higher weight, with higher visceral fat, comes all the metabolic complications that we look at in terms of higher insulin levels, higher levels of uric acid, ferritin, triglycerides, and all the other kind of blood pressure markers that really drive up the health consequences that go with that.
So how do we know when we have an issue with subcutaneous fat?
So you have to look at two ways. One, you can either do it directly or indirectly. The direct ways are basically start with your waist circumference, and that is the measure the circumference around your abdominal cavity at the level of your belly button. So it's not your jean size. It's actually probably larger than that, and you need a tape measure for that. It's probably the simplest kind of way to do that. For females, greater than 35 inches. For males, greater than 40 inches. If you want to become more sophisticated about it, you can do specialized imaging. A DEXA scan is actually able to give an estimate of this with certain software added on. It's best to ask that question before you get the DEXA scan because not all of them have it. And then you can go to levels like getting CT scans and MRIs. But really, for most people, a simple tape measure is going to be enough. Mm-hmm. The next question is are the consequences of that visceral fat a problem? And that's where the blood tests, etc. come in.
What are you looking for then when you see that the waist size is not where it should be and then you go down the route of the scans and the blood tests? What are you searching for?
So in the scans, you're looking for a greater concentration of weight in that abdominal cavity area. The actual breakdowns on DEXA scans will give you an estimation of that. There's different ratios we can actually use, but the best measure is if the company actually doing the DEXA scan has a specific what's called VAT mass analysis, and that's the amount of visceral adipose tissue. Mm-hmm. And so we can benchmark that against kind of your age and sex. So we know where that should be on a distribution for age and sex match peers. So that's obviously a very technical way to do it and requires, you know, a scan, some small amount of radiation exposure and some technical knowledge in terms of your provider to be able to do that. But again, for most people, a simple, you know, tape measure is going to be enough.
So now we all know how difficult it can be to shed the pounds that you can see. You're going to explain to us how to shed the pounds that maybe we can't see, the visceral fat.
And again, it all comes back to this idea of reversing insulin resistance and becoming more insulin sensitive. It is always going to be a multi-layered approach in terms of the lifestyle factors that we think about first, layered onto the potential consideration of medications and then potentially surgical options. But the first initial layer will always be starting with the four pillars of sleep, exercise, nutrition, and stress. Number one, are you getting 8 hours of sleep a night or kind of at least close to that? Because if you're not getting that sleep properly under your belt, the likelihood of you making decisions correctly for your exercise and nutrition are decreased. Then it's basically, have you your nutrition dialed in? Have you exercise dialed in terms of an amount of aerobic and resistance training? So when we do resistance training, we're increasing the muscle mass. When we do aerobic training, we're improving our ability to dispose of glucose. Mm-hmm. So that they're tackling different things. On top of that, then, if someone has those dialed in and they're not getting to their weight targets, we then think about the addition of certain medications, for example, that have been recently introduced, and for some individuals, bariatric surgery.
Okay. What are the medications that have been recently introduced that you would use?
So I think everyone has heard of these in some way or another. The group of medications called GLP-1 agonists,
semaglutide,
Ozempic, various different categories. And these are life-changing tools for patients who are looking to lose weight and have really put in the base work in terms of weight reduction. We've seen spectacular results in terms of weight reduction in terms of about 15% to 20% of body weight lost. But we know with that, and with all weight loss, comes reductions in muscle mass as well. So it's really important that if a patient is to go on those medications, which are really important tools for patients, that we are very careful about maintaining their protein intake, maintaining an aerobic and also a resistance training program to maintain their muscle mass. So we minimize the amount of muscle mass loss and maximize the amount of actual fat mass lost.
You'd be busy now if you were following all of these instructions, but I know you live what you preach. I mean, I see on your Twitter feed that you make an appointment to do your exercise. You're ticking your boxes, but you're making sure that it's in the diary and there's no escape.
Yeah, and so I say this to myself, as most anyone else. It was like, your physiology doesn't care about your schedule. It doesn't care if you're busy. And that's really difficult. I struggle with that myself. You know, in terms of I have been 20 kilograms heavier than I was. I have one of the significant genes for obesity. I have to work really hard to actually maintain my health regimen. But you just have to make that difference. But you also have to use the tools that are available to you. Mm-hmm. So in terms of that is, you know, if you're hitting all those targets, do you need those additional tools? Those medications we refer to as the GLP-1 agonists in terms of semaglutide, they're really important tools as an adjuvant to that.
Is your body always fighting to get back up to where it was, back up to where you are now plus 20 kilograms?
Not anymore. And so
how did you change the set point? That's the question we all
have. I think if I could, and that's persistence in terms of, but this is the interesting thing for me is that I don't fit into my jeans from my 21st. They're too big.
Right.
And so it's taken years of persistent effort to do that.
Dr. Paddy Barrett from Today with Claire Byrne. And back to that conversation between The Edge and Ryan Tuberty. Here, Ryan asked The Edge about his upcoming programme with Bono, a sort of homecoming with David Letterman.
I watched the documentary you made with David Letterman this morning. You didn't make it this morning, obviously. I watched it this morning. Bono and The Edge, a sort of homecoming. And it's a beautiful programme. It kind of showcases the album in many ways. It showcases certainly Dublin, for sure. But also you guys seeming very relaxed. And let me ask you a question, Edge. How would you describe Bono to somebody who's never met him before? Like, for example, an alien.
Well, I think Bono's, like all of us, a mixture of all the best with some, you know, aspects that are not the best. But that's what makes him so amazing is... His intent is always the positive. And, you know, from the get-go in our band, you know, we decided to look out for each other. And so the friendship and the success we've had is largely, I think, because of the culture of mutual support and friendship. And that kind of loyalty and is rare enough. You know, there's a quote that I always think of that would express the opposite of Bono, and I hope the opposite of all of us in U2, which is from Gore Vidal when he was asked about success. He said, you know, it's not enough to enjoy success. What's important is that your friends also fail. Right? And I just thought, whoa, that's the opposite. It's like we are all about each other succeeding.
Yeah.
And we're there for each other in that sense. So that's what I would say. So in that regard, I think that's some of the best aspects of what human beings are about is that, I don't know what you'd call that. I suppose it's cooperation on a very basic level, but it's empathy as well.
Are you the most democratic boy band that ever existed?
Well, you know, there's within U2, it's not equal, but I think what we have is equal respect in the sense that we all do what we can, and you know, that varies hugely between the four members, but we're all important and we're all given, you know, that credit of being a member, and that means we're all on the same level. Doesn't translate necessarily into actions. You know, like if somebody's spending huge amounts of time on something, the others have to acknowledge that and go, look, you know, we're just not as up to speed on what you're doing, so you tell us what you think ought to happen here. So it's not, we don't vote on stuff, you know, so we're not democratic in that sense. What we do is we get behind what seems to be the prevailing sentiment, you know. Mm-hmm. So this seems to be what everyone wants to do. Let's get behind that. And it's, look, it's worked over many years. So
it ain't broken. It ain't broken.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about watching you in that documentary. And again, having met you a few times, not too many times, I don't want to overstate the case, but anytime I have, I've always felt you're very courteous, very gentlemanly. And not, I don't know if introvert is the right word, but is, or maybe it's this way, in a room with Bono, who is somebody who is so interesting and also very charming person to meet, but in a room with somebody with a personality that big, is everyone an introvert, whether they like it or not?
Maybe. I mean, look, I don't crave the spotlight. If somebody's as fascinating and, you know, holding court, I'm quite happy to let them do that. You know, I'm more interested in what they're saying than necessarily making everyone listen to me.
Yeah.
and I'm comfortable with that.
And do you this when you say I don't chase the limelight? I'm always kind of puzzled by that, because you're in one of the biggest bands that ever existed on stage with all those tens of thousands over and over and over again. And yet you don't chase the limelight. And again, it's not meant to be pejorative or prejudicial or whatever you want to call it, or judgy. I'm just curious as to how do you marry the lack of interest in the limelight with all the adulation?
Well, I'm not saying I suffer from stage fright. I suppose what I'm saying is I'm a great sideman. And I think that's a term Keith Richards coined to describe his role in the Stones. You know, he's a great sideman. There's something to that. And I would place myself in that role.
And then a question from a fan.
Would you mind asking The Edge why he's called The Edge? I'm sorry, I'm probably the only person in the whole of Ireland that doesn't know the answer to this. So you probably have a quick answer for that too, do you?
Well, the thing is, we were, as I say, friends before we were certainly a professional band. And in our group of friends were included some characters who are still in our lives. Googie.
Yeah,
who's now a painter, and Gavin Friday, who is still a musician. They were friends of ours, and they formed a band called the Virgin Prunes. But in this larger group, we called ourselves Lipton Village. Mm-hmm. There was this tradition of giving nicknames to people, not just our friends and people around us, but people that we came across. So, you know, people would be called Burgundy or the Goose or Little Biddy One Way Street or... You know, there was a Gook Pants Delaney. So in that tradition of giving up nicknames, Bono was given the nickname. His first nickname actually was Heinrich van Steichen, bang, bang, bang. But that was a bit of a mouthful. So we changed that to Bonavox of O'Connell Street. And my nickname was The Edge. I think Larry's was The Jam Jar and Adam was Mrs. Burns. So for whatever reason, Bono Vox of O'Connell Street got shortened to Bono, and The Edge stuck, and we just ran with it.
Okay,
these were our nicknames.
There was no rhyme or reason to you being The Edge, was there? I mean, I think Bono said like you looked like The Edge. I don't know what that means.
I think what it was is in many cases, these nicknames were kind of onomatopoeic. They were to describe the look. So in my case, I think it was the chin inspired The Edge. In fact, before The Edge, I think I was known as In Shakur. Again, probably the same. For the chin. And Gavin Friday is not his actual name. Fanon Handley.
Lord.
Yeah. And Googie, Derek Rowan. So, you know, a lot of people kept their nicknames.
And why wouldn't they? One last one is that I know Bono's an Elvis fan. Are you a big Elvis fan?
Yeah, I'm an Elvis fan, but. Yeah, he wouldn't be like my top five, but yes, how could you not be?
Thank God he's passed away. He'd be very offended. But when the reason I think it is because you guys are going to just love being in Vegas. That's my clumsy segue. But the point is, you're going to be going to Vegas in, as the ad says, the fall. You're going to be Larry-less because he's getting over, you know, obviously all those years of drumming. But you've got a great drummer to replace him. But just a few thoughts on the Vegas residency. It's believe the venue is Knockout. How are you feeling about it? And you know, tell us a few thoughts on that.
Well, first of all, the attraction is the venue, really. I don't think we'd be considering going to play in Vegas if it was just any regular kind of residency. This is a state-of-the-art venue, the like of which doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. So it's light years ahead of any other venue in terms of design and the technology involved. And it's 18,000 to 20,000 people. So it's a fairly substantial size. And why it's appealing to us is it's this combination of sound and pictures that is a canvas for us that we're just dying to get our hands on. The sound quality will be phenomenal because it's purpose built for audio, and then the visuals. I mean, the size of this canvas is phenomenal. It's 120,000 square feet of LED screen inside, and there's also another screen on the outside of the building, which we will get to play with from time to time. So the combination of of the different technologies gives us the chance to do a kind of show that's never been done. And that's the thing that always gets you too excited, is the idea that we're breaking new ground, we're innovating, that we're basically finding a new way to present our music to our fans that marries great audio and the live experience with sort of visuals that that meet the songs and add a different layer of understanding to the material.
The Edge on the Ryan Tubridy Show. And on Today with Claire Byrne, post-pandemic, why trust in science matters with Dr. Shane Bergen.
Now, many of the big issues facing 21st century society have scientific dimensions. And if we are to learn from experiences like COVID, and if we are to survive the effects of climate change, we must consider the way society engages with science, the role of experts and our trust in them. Well, here to talk to us about public trust in scientific expertise is physicist Dr. Shane Bergen from the UCD School of Education, who has published a new podcast on this very topic, and it's called The Trust Race. Good morning to you.
Good morning
to see you. So you're going to talk to us all about this, and congratulations on the podcast. So what makes a scientific expert trustworthy at a very basic level?
Well, we could take a step back and ask what makes any expert trustworthy, right? Be it your doctor, your plumber, radio presenter or scientist. There's certain attributes that we can look at. So the first thing is like their education and their training, so their background and their credentials and their experience, simple things, you know. And I think all of that is very simple to ascertain if you're talking about a plumber or even your doctor, where the fix is rather immediate. But when it comes to things that are a little bit more abstract, like science, establishing trust in scientific expertise is a little bit more tricky. And so we have to look and see, is the person acting ethically? Do they have conflicts of interest? Why are they giving the view that they're giving? In other words, you always ask that question, what do they stand to get from the point of view that they're putting forward? I think in recent years, we've seen like a plethora of experts coming forth on lots of topics. And there has been a bit of a pushback to say, do you know what? There's just so many of them, and so many of them disagree with each other. I'll just do my own thing. That doesn't work, right? For the same reason that you can't extract your own tooth or perform surgery on yourself, you need to rely on experts in order for you to get through life. That requires a leap of faith. You have to trust them. What I'm suggesting, and what other experts are suggesting, experts on experts, is that you shouldn't do that blindly. That you should really think about the experts that you're interacting with in your life and figure out whether you should trust them or not. And I would always say that you should incline towards trust. There is a leap of faith involved, and that you should basically give people the benefit of the doubt, but be somewhat skeptical as you go.
Yes, and we saw that a lot, didn't we, during the pandemic on social media. I've done my own research and therefore I'm not going to do X or I am going to do Y. And the reason, I suppose, one of the reasons why that happens is that trust is hard to build, but it's really easily broken, isn't it?
It's so easily broken. And, you know, I'm a scientist, and all it takes is for a handful of scientists amongst the thousands in the world or hundreds in Ireland to break that trust for the public to rightly be suspicious of us all. And so when trust is broken, it's very hard to rebuild it. But I think that trust is crucial because, as you said at the start, the big issues that face our society have a strong scientific dimension, but they also involve people and people making trust. And it is essential that we can create a climate of trust if we are to survive things like climate change. And so I'm really interested in scandals and controversies that have impacted our trust in science and figuring out what can we learn from them. You know, there's this whole debate at the moment about the COVID inquiry. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a feeling that it could turn into, well, here's the people that did the things wrong, right? And we want names and we want heads to roll, that kind of logic. I think that that's a disastrous way to approach it. I think we really need to see, what can we learn from COVID that we could apply to other socio-scientific issues? What can we learn from COVID, which was, in the grand scale of things, a small emergency compared to what climate is going to be like in the next century? So in other words, how did we use expertise? How do we interact with all those people? What can we get from it that we can do the next emergency better?
And Claire played a clip from Shane's podcast featuring Professor Heather Douglas on COVID measures.
Then combine that with, you know, a president like Trump, who is just, I'm not wearing that. Americans viewed it as sort of like an impersonal imposition. And instead of saying, like, look, there are all kinds of things we do for public good that also help protect us. We chlorinate drinking water, we treat it, and we have speed limit signs, and we require driver's licenses. There are all kinds of these public goods. Americans are really bad at talking about public goods, and it seems like there's always a subset of any given society that's very suspicious of public goods.
Straight in with the controversial one, the mask wearing. That became so contentious, didn't it?
It did, yet for something that's so simple, right? That you wear a mask to stop breathing out the virus or inhaling it. But it became a political thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very interested as to how that happened. How could something that's so obviously effective become so polarizing?
Well, some experts were in here telling us that they weren't sure how effective they were, and, you know, weren't sure about the value of them, and people would have dirty hands and they'd be shoving them in their pockets and putting them back on and they'd be useless as a result.
Absolutely. And so we didn't know the science fully at the start, and the science evolved as the pandemic evolved. So we knew nothing much about how COVID was transmitted at the start, but we quickly figured that out. Yet there was a legacy then from that, right? So because we weren't sure who to believe, we kind of adopted this, or it was easy for us to adopt positions of going, do you know what? They keep changing their mind. I'm just going to do my own thing. Where what could have happened is we could have done a better job in explaining how science works, right? And in other words, how the research is evolving and how the experts change with the research.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that also advice around mask wearing wasn't always given on the right basis. So at the start, really, we were told to not wear masks because the healthcare officials were worried we'd run out of masks, right? So instead, we were just told, oh, we're not so sure. We can't really trust you to put them on correctly. So maybe just leave it for the time being. And that wasn't the right basis. If people had been a little bit more honest and forward with their reasons for hesitancy, we might have said, look, they don't know right now. We'll have to wait and see what they say. But yet every scientist was being asked back in April 2020, you know, should you wear a mask? Should you not wear a mask? A yes or no answer. And then that kind of led into all the confusion. And it was perfect for those who are political actors who wanted to take advantage of that division and to wedge in their politics into it.
But in order to get consensus, you'd have to have all of those experts agreeing. And that's rarely going to happen, is it?
Well, that's how science works. So we have a process, the peer review process. It can take time. Now, it had massively accelerated during COVID, and the rate at which science was done during the pandemic was incredible. To think that the virus was first spoken about in late 2019, and we had vaccines for it with it a little over a year and a half later, and we very quickly figured out how the virus was transmitted and how it could be blocked, etc. There is virtually no scientist now who will say that masks aren't effective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that there's consensus now, and it didn't take that long for consensus to emerge. So it was really about how do we deal with science stories when the science is evolving.
Okay, now you looked into the HIV/AIDS crisis back in the 1980s and how science ignored people's suffering.
Yeah.
What happened there?
Well, as a scientist, kind of one of the things that draws me in is this idea that it's for the common good, right? That the work we're doing in our labs is for everyone's benefit. But of course, like, that's not really always that true, because we're people at the same time. You know, I'm a scientist, but I'm also a human. So I have all the biases that any other human can have. And we saw back in the 1980s how homophobia effectively stopped or delayed research into AIDS, HIV. This was at a time when the New York Times wasn't able to publish the word gay, right? So people were dying in their hundreds, if not thousands. And it took people in that community to step up or to act up. Sarah Shulman is somebody I spoke to for the podcast, and she spoke about community or grassroots organizations that had to lobby and protest to get politicians and to get scientists to take it seriously, that basically it wasn't some sort of, you know, disease that was given to them because they were gay, and this was a serious thing, and that research needed to be done to help people and to stop them from dying.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked. It did work. So we can now see, like it's 40 something years ago, we can now see the effects of that community activism and how it changed science policy.
And the horror of treatments being available at that time for some of the symptoms, certainly in the beginning,
yeah,
not being made available to people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because of that bias.
Yeah, and it still exists. So you can see that there's talk at the moment in the UK around, you know, the NHS provides healthcare to people there. And there's a drug you can take called PrEP, which is something that can prevent you or lower the risk of you contracting HIV. And so the NHS now offers that drug, but there was massive pushback from right-wing media around it being offered because it was basically saying, you know, we'll give this drug on the NHS and people are going to go out there and be really promiscuous and have sex with lots of people. And the way they framed it in the media was, if you give that drug to LGBT people or anyone else, then we're going to have to take money away from other people. And they picked cystic fibrosis. So they said, you know, we won't give the money to the LGBT community because we have to give it to the cystic fibrosis community. What actually happened was cystic fibrosis organisations and those advocating for PrEP came together and said this is a nonsense.
Mm-hmm. And Shane spoke about the discussions around climate change.
The defining issue of the 21st century is, as far as we know, going to be climate change.
So how then will we use what we learned from HIV and AIDS and COVID to deal with climate change and respond in a scientific way? And we're basing this all around the trust aspect.
Absolutely. And that is it. We need to create a climate of trust. That's the hope. Right, is that if we can come together, we can talk to each other, we can listen to each other's points of view and recognise that people are scared and people don't know what to do. And there isn't a single simple solution to this. It's really complex. So I'm always wary of people who have simple solutions to complex problems. It is a complex problem. It requires a complex response. Mm-hmm. And I think in Ireland, we actually have, we wouldn't say a silver bullet, but we have a magic formula here, is that we have this capacity to talk to each other. And we do that at a political level using citizens' assemblies. And they have been shown in research, not just in Ireland, but internationally, to be the perfect way for us to bring contentious or controversial issues to a public space and have people talk about it, to hear expert view, but also to hear the views of people with lived experience. People what might have community-based knowledge or a particular perspective, and for us to have to start to trust each other so that we recognise that all of the issues are equally important, experts matter, and that we have to together figure out a way forward.
So you think that the citizens' assembly model builds trust, because some would say, oh, that's just government abdicating responsibility and handing it over to 100 people in a room to make a decision.
I really dislike that model, because if you extend that, you'd say, let's get rid of the media, right? You know, so like or let's get rid of academia. Democracy works because we are all invested in it. The government is not devolving their responsibility by forming citizens' assemblies. They are being informed by it. Mm-hmm. And it's really important that politicians take leadership. Hannah Daly in UCC, who contributes to the podcast, says she worries that things will have to get a lot worse for them to get better when it comes to climate. And I'm curious to know, what will be the thing that turns the tide? What will be the issue that eventually we will recognise that the policies we're using at the moment have us set on a course for disaster, right? And that comes down to us perhaps feeling, I don't know how to respond, it's too big. There is an absence of political leadership in this space. Hannah talks in the podcast about politicians just being too worried to step forward and not knowing, or it becoming a political wedge issue, right? We can see now that some people are trying to position green politics as being on the left. And that's a disaster because, you know, we see in our history, it comes to something like the North, it takes an all of Ireland or an all of humanity response for us to really move forward.
Dr. Shane Bergen from Today with Claire Byrne. And that's it for Playback Daily, so mind yourself till next time.